This is CD 9 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a 4-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. This CD contains session number 9 titled Renunciation Purification 1.
In our last gathering, we talked about sacrifice and the more profound aspect of the sacrifice, which is not the sacrifice of things, but the sacrifice of self, the sacrifice of even knowing, the sacrifice of trying, the sacrifice of thinking you're doing anything, the sacrifice of your own personal trip. And that sacrifice is based first on the recognition that your body, your personality, your senses are all part of this nature process, the laws of prakriti. And so that wisdom allows you to stand back a little from being involved thinking you're the thinker or the doer. And then with the increasing depth of recognition of the Brahman, of that which lies behind, of that which is non-self, which is free of attributes and free of labels, which is the source from which all keeps feeding outward. With the recognition of that, that is the spiritual root of the universe, then the sacrifice takes on another aspect, which is the sacrificing of all form, of all worldly vibration, of all life as you know it, into that spirit. And it's as if you are pouring it into the mouth of Brahman, into the fire that is Brahman, pouring it inward. And as you pour that in, and all of your efforts become that offering, you are in effect turning yourself inside out. Until finally, you are the Atman. You are that light within. You are that consciousness. You are that space. You are that presence. You are... And at that point, all of your actions and efforts and forms and expressions become merely the expressions of the Dharma. They are no longer you doing it for your own personal trippiness. It's not what I can get out of it or what's in it for me. And it's just this entire conversion that goes on. And if you can extrapolate it outward and see that in our culture it's very obvious that people gain some kind of meaning to their lives from identity with reference groups. Maybe their reference group is themselves, or maybe it's their religion, their church. Could be the Rotary Club, the Lions, the Moose. It could be America. It could be a repressed minority group. It could be one sex. And person gets identity from that, and they can do things for a cause, quote, larger than themselves that they couldn't do for themselves. Well, now just keep going out and out and out and out until the cause that is larger than oneself is it all, is the Dharma, is the divine law. And assume that's your reference group. And so... you're not getting any longer. However, in most reference group work, there is a rush from being good in relation to the values of the reference group. That's one you got to surrender to here. There's nowhere to hold. There's nowhere you can hold on. And someone who has so surrendered, who has become turned inside out, is then a statement of Dharma and may look any way at all. And we'll be talking about how they may look any way at all as we go on today. Now, throughout the Gita, there is a consideration of the role of what would be called purification. It isn't as extensively dealt with in the Gita as it might be because there is a certain assumption underlying the Gita that everybody already knows all that. It wasn't really written totally with our present Kali Yuga mentality in mind, the dark age, the age where we've gotten totally caught in worldly things. And it was assumed at this time, for example, that Arjuna already knew all the purification acts, which many of us are still struggling to even understand. Let me just read you a few of the Gita quotes. From the world of the senses comes heat and comes cold, Arjuna, and pleasure and pain. They come and they go, they are transient. Arise above them, strong soul. The man whom these cannot move, whose soul is one beyond pleasure and pain, is worthy of life in eternity. When in recollection he withdraws all his senses from the attractions of the pleasures of sense, even as a tortoise withdraws all its limbs, then his is a serene wisdom. Even desires disappear when the soul has seen the Supreme. The restless violence of the senses impetuously carries away the mind of even a wise man striving towards perfection. Bringing them all into the harmony of recollection, recollecting them, let him sit in devotion and union. For when his senses are in harmony, then his is a serene wisdom. When a man dwells on the pleasures of senses, attractions for them arise in him. From attraction arises desire, the lust of possession, and this leads to passion and anger. When the mind becomes bound to a passion of the wandering senses, this passion carries away man's wisdom, even as the wind drives a vessel on the waves. For the man who forsakes all desires and abandons all pride of possession and of self reaches the goal of peace supreme. Hate and lust for things of nature have their roots in man's lower nature. Let him not fall under their power. They are the two enemies of his path. Do thy duty, even if it be humble. And Arjuna asked Krishna, what power is it, Krishna, that drives man to act sinfully? Krishna answers, it is greedy desire and wrath born of passion, the great evil, the sum of destruction. This is the enemy of the soul. All is clouded by desire, as fire by smoke, as mirror by dust, as an unborn babe by its covering. Wisdom is clouded by desire, the ever-present enemy of the wise, desire in its innumerable forms, which like a fire cannot find satisfaction. Desire has found a place in man's senses and mind and reason. Through these it blinds the soul after having overclouded wisdom. Know that a man of true renunciation is he who craves not nor hates. For he is who is above the two contraries soon finds his freedom. He who on this earth before his departure can endure the storms of desire and wrath, this man is a yogi, this man has joy. Day after day let the yogi practice the harmony of soul in a secret place, in deep solitude, master of his mind, hoping for nothing, desiring nothing. Let him find a place that is pure and a seat that is restful, neither too high nor too low, with sacred grass and a skin and a cloth thereon. On that seat let him rest and practice yoga for the purification of the soul. With the life of his body and mind in peace, his soul in silence before the One. With upright body, head, and neck, which rests still and move not, with inner gaze which is not restless but rests still between the eyebrows, with soul in peace, with all fear gone, and strong in the vow of holiness, let him rest with mind in harmony, his soul on me, his God supreme. The process the Gita expounds would seem to be to detach the senses from their proper objects. For hither and thither the senses rove. And if you recall, the buddhi, which is the soul, that higher intellect, the third eye, the place that can go, that can recognize the Atman, or be pulled down by the mind, the manas, which in turn is captured by the indriyas, the senses, which are fixed on sense objects. So there's sense object, there is sense, there is mind, which knows sense, and there is higher mind, which can be caught in that worldly pull outward into the senses and the thinking mind, or it can withdraw and retreat inward and become a recognizer of the Atman, which is that aspect of the Brahman in each individual. And so there are many strategies for this process of extricating the buddhi from being caught in the sense objects. You can stop at the level of cutting off the sense objects. You can stop at the level of extricating the sense itself from the mind. You can work on the mind itself by quieting it down so it doesn't respond to the senses. You can fill your mind with wisdom of that which is beyond all of this. The whole process of purification is a technique of putting yourself in a position to experience the kind of personal, direct, first-hand knowledge of the Brahman, or of Nibbana, if you will. That is, all of the purification rituals which exist in Hinduism, they exist in Buddhism, they exist in Christianity, they exist in Judaism, they exist in the Muslim religion, and on, and they all overlap incredibly. All of these purification components are done in order to cool you out so that you're not creating so much heavy karma every day that you're totally preoccupied with the stuff you're creating each day. And the minute that preoccupation lightens just a bit, then you can start to deepen your meditation. And with the deepening of meditation, you start to appreciate the deeper wisdom, that wisdom which can't be studied in books. So as I mentioned before, and if you keep in mind in examining your own sequence of sadhana, there was some knowledge that gets you to want to even think about the whole matter of yoga or enlightenment. And that knowledge leads you to maybe want to try to meditate. And you sit down to meditate and you're so agitated. And in a way to quiet the agitation, you become interested in your diet. You become interested in the way in which you take care of your body. You become interested in who you hang out with. You become interested in what you think the rest of the time. Because you see, all this stuff is feeding in to that agitation, which is keeping you from meditating. And then you get pulled, if you will, towards purification rituals. Not because you're a good gal or a good guy and you think you ought to do it. It's not good and evil. It's just that you can't not do it. In this mentality that pervades the Naropa model that there's nothing to do, it's in that model that you can do all this stuff. Not because you think there's something to do, but because it's just what has to happen next. Just what has to happen next. And as this purification ritual goes on, you quiet down. And you stop creating so many waves for yourself. And as you quiet and don't create so many waves, and you're not so pulled by this and that and grabbed by so much, then the meditation gets deeper. The samadhi gets more one-pointed. And as that samadhi gets deeper, you enter into the places of higher wisdom. And that's the sequence, and it's very spirally. And you can't jump the gun. You can't just override all of the stuff that's built up in you. It's like just living in the marketplace until you know how to transmute all that energy, which is the form of tantra. The amount of toxins that build up in you. It's like if you're driving down the street and somebody cuts off your car and you go through, why you... Just that, the vibration, the energy that's fed in by that is resonating and resonating. It's setting up anger and all the passions are at work. And that's not the setting. Your body and your emotions and your mind are part of your setting for your meditation. And the reason you work with possessions and attachments is because where your treasures are, there will your heart be also. So says Jesus. Where your treasures are, there will your heart be also. And if you, for example, have a very beautiful something or other, okay, and you go to sit down and meditate, before the meditation takes you beyond yourself, there will be some very, very powerful thoughts about protecting that something or other. Did I lock it? Yeah. And you begin to see people being chained by the chain of their possessions. And their possessions can be emotional possessions, can be intellectual possessions. It's like you just start to meditate, see? And you have this great idea. Okay? And you say, gee, I mustn't forget that idea because, you know, I can make a million on that. Or that'll help humanity. That's a nice one. That's a good one. And then you try to meditate. And every time you meditate, as your mind starts to get quiet, suddenly you grab back at the idea for fear you'll forget it. Okay. Not yet is your faith strong enough that where you're going in meditation, all the ideas will still be there. You can give it all up. It'll all be around. You don't have to worry. If it was a good idea, it'll come back. That's a deep fate. But sometimes when the idea is so good, I'll write it down, see? Then I can meditate, see? Because then I'm not holding the attachment. But the attachment's still there, of course. It's just a kapha. But as long as you want this or that, or you're collecting this and that, or you're possessing this and that, and that whole business of purification is concerned with just lightening that agitation. In this Egyptian book, it says, get in your mind the vision of the valley. Look at the valley from the most destitute to the wealthiest. Each person there spends his days one after the other in the narrow daily round of passions, greed, hatred, desire, and grasping at satisfactions. If you want to abandon this road through the valley, I do not say that you should abandon these pleasures, but rather let your desire be at the same level as your goal. If you aspire to superhuman joy, accept the superhuman struggle in a very human body, and know that the abyss is always a near neighbor to the summit. Realize that in the nature package, with all of the yogunas and all the forces, are all these desires, passions, emotions, thoughts, just all there. And that's your package. And at any moment, it will recapture you. My teacher, Haridas, used to say to me, even a 93-year-old saint is not safe. See? Meaning, there's always the possibility of the pull coming and grabbing you back again. And if you're going to play this game, you're going to have to deal with the battle of Kurukshetra, which is just what we're talking about, the battle of the power of all the pulls of nature in you. Okay. And whether you're doing renunciation, which we're talking about today, or Tantra, you still have to deal with the pulls of these desires. Because the way these pulls all work for reproduction, for survival, they all work on using the ego. So that for most of us, for example, sex has gotten so far from reproduction as an issue. I used to say in my lectures, Gandhi said, the only reason you would have sex is to reproduce, but I found that very few people in a Western audience were ready to hear that. I could say it, but everybody would just get tight and say, well, don't lay that moralistic trip on us. You know, these are the days of sexual freedom. The first time I ever used that was in a lecture I was giving in Berkeley at the beginning of the sexual freedom movement, when there were about 50 people and one couple were screwing right in front of me on the couch to show they were making a sexual freedom statement, right? And I just started talking about Gandhi making the statement, and I saw them getting more and more. He was losing his erection. The whole thing was going to hell because... And even right to the very end of the whole sadhana, as long as there is somebody at all there, all this stuff is still lurking and available and can pull. And if you recall, Paul said in his letter to the Corinthians, and by reason of the exceeding greatness of the revelations, wherefore that I should not be exalted overmuch, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me. Well, whether you want to consider your desires as messengers of Satan, in that case, good and evil really is referring to those forces which pull you back into the world and those which release you to recognize the Spirit. Living in the Spirit, you are then once again much in the world, but you are not of the world. You are not caught in the world. A lot of people hear renunciation as if somehow we're saying that the world is bad, therefore renounce the world. And that isn't the issue at all. That's beating a dead horse in a way. The only thing you are doing is you are starting out for a place where you are caught, bound hand and foot, and through a set of methods you are extricating yourself from being bound that way so that when you are free, you are then free to participate in it all or not participate. But prior to the sadhana, or prior to the awakening, you must participate. You are driven by participation. You are, as it were, a mechanical being just running off stuff. You are merely part of the drama of nature, which is suffering, as Buddha pointed out. So the extrication from suffering is extricating oneself from being attached to the worldly dance. Not that you can't do it or enjoy it or have all of it. Get it all. But you can't sit around wanting it and saying, okay, I'll give it up so I can get it all. You can't have it both ways. Because it knows. Gandhi said an interesting thing. He said, the essence of civilization consists not in the multiplication of wants. You notice the way our society works. It keeps fanning desires. If you watch the way advertising is built, it's built on just the opposite of what we're talking about. It's built on making you more and more dissatisfied by making you think you want more and more things. It's by creating it all. If you don't have this, you couldn't possibly be happy. Okay. Every 3 or 4 minutes on television, there is another statement that is made to create in you a desire. You've got to have it. You must want it. You know, when you're in India, sometimes you feel, even though the economics are so horrendous, you feel you're at last in a civilized country. And you feel often that in our country, with all of its affluence, it isn't yet very civilized. It's pretty new. You know, it's a pretty young country. Gandhi says, the essence of civilization consists not in the multiplication of wants, but in their deliberate and voluntary renunciation. That is, you begin to give up things not because you're a martyr or a masochist or because you're a good guy, but because what you're identified with is much more interesting than just the immediate gratification, the next chocolate bar. Right? We used to do experiments in psychology to determine delay of gratification. The question is, would people give up a little candy bar now for a big one later? You know? And how big would the one have to be later for them to give up the little one now? And who could give up which and how old and all that stuff? Okay. And we saw that society was a training in deliberate renunciation of immediate gratification. Okay. But that was always for just more of the same desire later. But when you see that being attached to desires themselves is inevitably going to lead to more and more suffering, more tsaras, more continuing discomfort, at that point you begin to want to get free of the whole bag. And then the renunciation comes out of wisdom. It doesn't come out of fear or out of guilt or out of anything. But there is very little support system in America for purification, because most all of the culture in the United States is built on more gratification, sooner is better. More is better, sooner is best. Right? See? And if you look at what people do with wealth in America, with affluence, they try to create more and more and more sensual gratification. And then when they are totally jaded with that, and they begin to feel the falling away of their desires, their desperateness at that point makes them try to buy eternality by huge buildings which they give in charity and so on. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair, said Ozymandias. Nothing more remains. Out of the whole kingdom Ozymandias built out in the desert, there's only one stone left above the dunes of sand that have gone in over the kingdom, and it says, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Because it all passes, it's all transient. And the thing is, you take your body just as it is, and your mind and your feelings and your thoughts just as they are, and right in this place lies the Atman, lies the Brahman, lies Nibbana, lies the enlightened state. It's right here. It's not there or then. It's not in India or Ceylon or Tibet. It's not being kept by him or her. It's not in that book or this book. It's right here. You are it. So then the process becomes one of just cleaning away or doing whatever it is you don't do but can't not do until you become it. All right? I'm being careful. You just have to stay conscious because you know that somebody's counting. The problem is that as you deal with tapasya or austerities, people keep getting into the model that somehow the renunciation is connected with good and evil. That it's better to give up sex. It's better to fast. It's better. And it has nothing to do with better or worse. That isn't what the game is. You're not a good person because you do it. That isn't what it's about. It isn't the sattvic trap of being a nice person. And you give these things up because you want to give them up. That's far out. I mean, I've faced that many times, and it's always horrified me. You know, when I've had a desire for something for years and years and years, and suddenly I know that every time I eat that thing, it leaves me logy, or like, for example, for me, smoking pot is a good example. Like, I really dig smoking pot. I think it's fun. I get high, you know, and I, wow, and my mind goes, brrr, and it's all the feelies and the sensies and the touchies. It's all so, you know, and sex is groovy. Oh, boy, it's just, you know, lots of fun, no doubt about it. And the next day, my frontal lobes are all sort of, I sit down and meditate, and I feel like, And I realize that every time I overload the system neurochemically, there is a cost involved until I can get rid of the model that every time I overload the system, there's a cost. But in the meantime, until the Messiah comes, see, I find that I lose interest in smoking because I really don't want to have to deal with all that stuff in my body later on. And every now and then I'll deal with it. You know, I'll do it again and just go around again. I was doing a sadhana where I was doing pranayama, a type of breath control, which was so fine that if I took even an extra half a glass of milk, I'd get ill. And at that point, I couldn't take any psychedelic chemicals. And people started to say, they'd interview me and they'd say, well, we're happy to see that you've given up drugs. Would you comment on that? You know, and I got horrified at what I was getting caught in. And all I could think of was Ramana Maharshi saying, I didn't eat, and they said I was fasting. And that's really the essence of tapasya. Because as long as you think you're doing the austerity, look what a good person I am, I'm giving this up, you're on such an ego trip, it's incredible. Like my sequence of fasting, which will bring us to our food work today. The sequence of fasting was, in 67, when I was at the temple in India, Haridas said to me, I noticed that everybody around fasted a lot. And I said, Haridas, can I fast? I wrote on my slate, we were silent. Haridas said, if you'd like. I said, how long can I fast for? He said, 4 days would be good. I said, how long do you fast for? He said, 9 days on the new moon. So I thought, well, if he can do it, I can do it. So I said, I will fast for 9 days. And I looked very holy. And the time came for the fasting, and I started to fast. And as some of you know, I spent the entire 9 days thinking about all the different restaurants I'd been in America. And the Thanksgiving dinners I'd had as a child. And I'd visualized the cranberry sauce made as turkeys and the sweet potatoes with marshmallows on the top and the stuffings and the different kind of stuffings and how the gravy would be and what the first bite would taste like. And I just live out at that again and again, and the cracked crab in the Northwest and steak and original Joe's and bouillabaisse and here and lobster Savannah in Boston. And oh boy, and I just was, because I was a cross between a gourmet and a gourmand for years. But I made it through the 9 days. But the interesting question was, what was it I was feeding? You know? Because it was, I think there were very few hours of my waking time that I was not thinking about food. The next fast, 3 months later, when I did the 9 day fast, I was getting much better. Better. New ego trip, you see. Now, I spent the whole time thinking about only foods I could eat. Okay? So I thought about spinach, see, with lemon on it, and rice, and steaming bowls of rice and spinach, and I'd smell them, and I just, you know, chapatis and dude milk. And I was doing fasts all those times and thinking, aren't I good? I'm doing 9 day fasts, just like the book says. I'm becoming a great hatha yogi. About 2-3 years ago, we were in India, and we were up in a village, and it got an opportunity for me to fast again for a long period of time. And this time, when I fasted, except for the fact that when at noontime lemon and water or tea was brought instead of food, I never even noticed I was fasting. And about halfway through it, I thought, oh, this is what fasting is about. Far out. I hadn't even known what it was about. Because I was so busy thinking that the ego tripping I was doing was tapasya, was an austerity of some sort. And I think the real understanding of an austerity is you are so ripe to do it that you just do it joyfully. It's just, yeah, right. 5, 10 years ago, I used to fill every place I lived. The first thing I needed was a record player, hi-fi system, my books, beautiful tapestries, soft things, warm things, bath salts, incense, wines, foods, just surrounding myself with this luxurious cave of stuff. And every time I moved, I needed a truck or a U-Haul or a whatever it was, right? And then I noticed it all started to get simpler and simpler and simpler and simpler until, although I'm, Naropa's taking nice care of me now, when I'm sitting in a place where somebody gives me an empty room with white walls and I put my mat down and sit down, I'm really just about as content as I ever was with all that stuff. It's just gotten simpler and lighter and simpler and lighter. People come and they say, I could never live like that. You're very courageous. But you begin to realize it has nothing to do with courage. You just laugh. You know? It has nothing to do with courage. Often when I'm traveling around the country, people say, come and stay in our home. And I say, no, I stay in motels. And they say, motels? See, but the thing about a motel is it's total plastic impersonality. If I go into somebody's home, it's full of stuff that's saying, look at me. You know? It's very hard to quiet your mind in a home because it's so full of loving objects. Of this one and this one, and notice this, and look at this beautiful picture, and if you felt this, and you lie down, you go to sit and meditate, and you put your hands down, and it feels so good. It feels so good. And you open your eyes, and there on the wall is something that was made with total love, and it just pulls you in. Now, there is a time for the romanticism in life. There's a time when it falls away. There's a time when you're totally free of it, and then you can have it all again. Like, I go to visit Swami Muktananda at his ashram in Ganeshpuri, and I go into his suite, and there he is eating off sterling silver tables and chairs off 18-karat gold plates. I think, Zaya Yogi? What kind of a yogi is this? I mean, what could this trip be about, you know? Until I read the story of his sadhana, and realize how much nothing all that is. And that in that world of nothing, then when people lay on him gold plates, he uses them. It's the same as a leaf to him. As I was around him, I realized none of it meant anything. And it was so far, it was busy because it meant something to me. Well, I couldn't hear the possibility it didn't mean anything to him. The Ashtavakra Gita says, one who is attached to the world desires to renounce it in order to avoid suffering. But the sage who has no attachment does not suffer, even in the world. Even in the world. Now, what we're going to do for a little while now, right in the middle of this discussion, is to work with food as an exercise in bringing consciousness to an area in which desire often resides. Because other than air, food becomes most critical to survival, and because of its need in the species level of your incarnation, the desires get very strongly built into people. And there are ways of dealing with food as part of the process that everything you do in life and everything you have in life becomes part of the teaching, part of the awakening process, part of the awakening process. In the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, there is a shloka that concerns sacrifice. And in the notes connected with it in most texts, it says this shloka is often used in relation to eating by many people in India. Now, when somebody sees it from outside, it looks like I have this delightful thing with my father about doing this. I sit down and we sit at the table and we're about to eat. And he sits down, and as he sits down, His hand is on his fork as he's just sitting down, and before the chair is in, the first bite of salad, and he's halfway through the crunching of the lettuce when he realizes that I'm saying this blessing. See? So he stops in mid-crunch, because he's going to wait till the kid finishes. See, his blessing. Right. And every now and then, if I take too long, I hear a crunch. You know, it's like he's just pushing me just a little bit, like, get on with it. You know, there's just a... And it's a beautiful dialogue we go through, you know, and I don't try to lay it on too heavy, I don't, but I just do it quietly to myself. I don't care if he eats his lettuce, you know, I've told him then. Oh, no, no, I won't eat my lettuce while you're praying, you know. And he says to me, what are you saying? And I tell him, and he ends up, he joins in the shanti, shanti, shanti now. And then he says, amen. It's the best of all worlds. The idea of the shloka is, in view of what we've been talking about, that you are making an offering of this food, and you're making it to Blup, which we will call Blup Krishna, the Supreme Being, to God. Okay. But this shloka is very powerful, and it's very interesting in view of the Buddhist work we're going to be doing shortly. Because the shloka says... Realize that the food, that is the oblation, the ghee you're going to pour into the fire, the clarified butter, the food itself is part of Brahman. It's part of that unmanifest thing which lies behind form. Didn't you remember that? You thought it was food all the time. When all it is dense spirit. Right? Oh, but we're not going to stop there, it says. The food is Brahman. The fire into which you're offering the food, which you can interpret as your hunger, the fire of the hunger, the fire of your desire, or the sacred fire into which you throw the ghee or the clarified butter. The fire is part of Brahman too. You thought it was a fire? No, the fire is Brahman. So you're pouring Brahman into Brahman, right? Oh, but we haven't finished yet. Who do you think is doing it? You think you're doing it? You think you're going to eat the food to fulfill your desire? No. Okay. After all, you're Brahman too. So now it's Brahman offering Brahman into the fire of Brahman. And who are you offering it to? Who do you think all those beings are? God and all that? Where is that? Brahman. Far out. So it turns out you are Brahman offering Brahman to the fire of Brahman and offering it to Brahman. So nothing's happening at all. Okay. The whole thing is an illusion. Okay? It's all Brahman playing with Brahman. It's all the play of the Lord. It's all divine leela. And you just think you're going to eat this meal. Okay? Now, after that, if you can keep that in mind, then go ahead and enjoy your dinner. Okay? Because every time you take a bite, just remember you're not eating. Since you're not identified any longer with your hunger, and you're not identified with being the eater, and the food is just what it is, then you'll just eat what you need to eat. And you'll see it all as merely the play of Brahma. And the last half of this thing, which is not in the Gita, but which is added from a devotional context, is this food is offered to the various aspects of the way in which the spirit is manifest in the universe. So it's to the Guru, meaning God in manifest form, the Guru as creator, preserver, and change. That is Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. Devo Mahesh, as energy. All the universe is energy. The energy itself is divine. As that which lies behind all energy, Param Brahma. And then finally, I touch the lotus feet of the Guru. I surrender again. And then there is a silent place in which you add whatever blessings or metta you want to send out to anybody else of your good grace. And then shanti, shanti, shanti. We're just going to do it for you now. If you take a piece of food and hold it, if you have, and if you don't have one, somebody may be kind enough to offer you one. Like, I don't have one. I've been given a raisin by a Buddhist. It just seems to be a raisin. It just seems to be a Buddhist. Mmm.
Brahmapanam Brahmahavir Brahmagni Brahmanahotam Brahmaitan Gantabhyam Brahma Karma Samadhina Guru Brahma Guru Vishnu Guru Devo Maheshwara Guru Sakshat Param Brahma Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha.
Realizing the eater, that which is eaten, are both Brahman, and the whole process is done as a sacrifice that it all may merge into Brahman. Now there are other strategies of dealing with food in order to change the meaning of the food, the eating experience. One of them is a part of punya, or wisdom, that is a reperception of what it is that you're eating. And the other is a meditation exercise on eating itself. And these processes are guaranteed to change your experience of eating. I've asked Jack and Joseph to share with you these other perceptual techniques and experiment with them. So if you will take another piece of food and listen to Jack first.
Actually, the techniques that I'm going to share with you, which come from my teachers and out of the Buddhist tradition, are a number of them, and they're all designed for the same purpose of breaking the illusion of separateness between you and the food, or breaking the attachment or desire. For it's not what it is that you eat that makes you wise and leads to the development of insight, but the process of how you eat it that will lead to that. And the Buddhist emphasis is always on the attitude, the cultivation of certain mind states, the letting go of the attachment to sense desires. The first meditation that's done in the Buddhist tradition corresponds almost identically to what we've just done, is meditation on loving kindness and compassion, on the bodhisattva nature, and the sharing of your food with all the beings in existence. The Chinese, when they do this, in preparing a meal, will have a very special small plate and will take a portion of whatever food they prepared for their own selves and set it aside in that plate and make it as an offering on the puja table in preparation to doing a short chant. And I'll share with you one Buddhist chant, a Pali chant, that's often used with food. Sabbe lokami ye sata jivanta hara hetuka manunang bojanang sabbe labantu mama jetasa. May all sentient beings share with me this meal, and by the power of my merit, may all beings live with health and happiness. So throughout the meal, you keep to this mind state of loving kindness, of compassion, of sharing whatever is there with all the beings in the universe. Another technique to use in eating is to consider the elements. This to develop detachment and wisdom into the emptiness of self, or into the Brahmanic nature of all that you're doing. So you take your piece of food and you hold it up and look at it and realize in it the aspects of the earth element of solidity, of hardness or softness, of the element of fire, the heat or cold of it, of the air or vibratory element, element of distension that keeps it in that shape, and of the element of cohesion that keeps it together, the water element. And you see that in the food and you feel it, you examine it, and then you look at your own body and you say, wow, there's the element of hardness, of solidity, the element of heat and cold, the element of vibration, distension, of cohesion. So all I'm doing is taking the elements and putting the elements into elements. And you'll notice when you chew the elements that they change. The hardness gets, the cohesion increases and the hardness disappears somewhat. And you can watch the process of the transformation of the elements from the food as you chew them and swallow them. Another way to approach eating, meditation, is to do a meditation on the emptiness, again related to the Brahmanic meditation that was spoken of, where you take a piece of food and you see your body reaching for the food and holding it, and you look at your arm and the rest of your body and you realize that that's not you, that's just the body. And you look at the mind that knows, that's watching that, and you see that that's not you either. That's just awareness of the fact of the body or awareness of the food. And as one very famous Buddhist teacher said, eating is like putting nothing into nothing. Another technique to use to break down the illusion of self, of separateness, the illusion of permanence, is to look at the whole process of eating in terms of change, in the change of form, and also the change of feeling when you're doing the eating. I don't know what kinds of food each of you have, but you can imagine the genesis of most of it is food that grew from the earth, of the green shoot, the tree or the stalk or whatever, and the ripe fruit, and the picking of it, and the cleaning of it, bringing it, packaging to you, seeing the food there, and continuing the process in your mind first, before you eat, of considering the change of the food, the eating of it, the tasting and swallowing, the change of that food into elements, nutriments for your body, into excrement, back into the earth, and the whole cycle begins again of the regeneration of food. So that you see everything in terms of a flow, in terms of a process, and that it's all changing. And that's another way to look at eating as a meditation. Another way to do it is to be mindful of sensation and touch. Don't pick up your food yet. Sensation and mindfulness of sensation is the basis for a lot of vipassana or insight meditation practice, because it's something that you can see moment to moment changing very clearly, the arising and ceasing of sensation. So in eating now or in eating any meal, you can be aware first of the sensation of yourself sitting there. You can be aware of the sensation in yourself of hunger, of desire, the feeling in your body, sensation. When you reach for the food or the fork, you can be aware of the sensation of your hands touching the utensil or the food. Feel that in your fingers. Aware of the sensation of movement of your arm, bringing the food up to your mouth, and of the sensation of the touch on your lips, the sensation on your tongue and your teeth as you chew it, the sensation as you swallow, feeling it all the way go all the way down into your stomach. And by paying attention to the sensation, what you do is cut off the discrimination of your mind. You don't allow yourself to say, ooh, wow, that was delicious, or, oh, that was awful. You're just mindful of the process of the sensation arising and ceasing as you eat, and so you're able to cut the desires. A way that's very commonly taught in monasteries, and especially talked about among the bhikkhus or the monks in the Buddhist tradition, is to look at food just in terms of its sustenance. The contemplation of food for sustenance. The body is simply a vehicle to be cared for and not to be pampered, and food is simply a means of sustaining life to continue your spiritual practice. You're not eating because you enjoy eating, but you're eating as a way to sustain your energy to continue your practice on the spiritual path. And there's a story about the kind of attitude that eventually needs to be developed in this meditation on food for sustenance. There was a couple and a young child that were crossing a very vast desert. They brought very little food with them, and they had run out of food and just about run out of water. And they still had a long way to go, and they were quite sure, in fact, that they would die. Well, from the heat of the day in the desert, in fact, the child did die. And the two parents decided, in order to continue the crossing of the desert and their journey so they would not die, that they would eat the body of the child. And the attitude of taking food, not out of pleasure, not out of desire or out of attachment, but simply for sustenance, just as those parents ate the flesh of their own child, is an attitude, very powerful one, that breaks through the greed and the attachment to the sense pleasures of eating, and is another kind of meditation. When you've developed that attitude, you don't eat more than you need. All of these kinds of meditations are merely techniques, devices for developing balance in the mind, because the whole of the Dhamma is just a question of balance, really. Here you have to balance your greed and your habitual patterns of enjoyment to get you to a point where you're no longer attached. When I was first in the monastery in Laos, it was an ascetic monastery, and I'd been there a few weeks and was really checking it out to make sure that the teacher looked like he was enlightened and that all the monks were practicing right. And I saw some things I didn't like. Monks were a little sloppy eating, or they'd get their food and they'd say their chant and then they'd start to eat very fast. And even the teacher I wondered about. There were a lot of things I wondered about. He would say very contradictory things at times to different people. And I went to him, I was very disturbed, and I thought of leaving, going to find another teacher, a better guru who fit my model of what a teacher should be like. And I said, I feel really uncomfortable. Why do you say one thing to one person and one to another about how we should eat or how we should act? And his answer to me was, the way I teach is very simple, he said. It's like someone walking down a path or a road at night, and sometimes they get off a little bit onto the right side, and I see them and I say, go left. And sometimes they almost fall in the ditch on the left side, and I see them and I say, go right, go right. That's all I do. And all of the meditations are techniques to use to develop a balance of mind and mental factors. So I asked him further, I said, well, I'm still disturbed. Some of the monks are eating quickly, and even you sometimes seem to be sloppy. It's very hard to say. Thought a lightning bolt might strike me. Nothing happened. He just laughed, and he said, you have to be thankful for the appearance of imperfections in your teacher, the things that make him look like he's not enlightened. I said, oh yeah? And he said, because if it were not for these imperfections, you might be deceived into thinking that the Buddha was somewhere outside of yourself.
It's a good story, Jack.
The balance of mind is the key. And when there's a very strong imbalance, you need strong medicine to balance it. Some of us really get into food trips, the Thanksgiving dinner or the going to the refrigerator and the pickles and olives and cheesecake and all of those wonderful things. And in order to balance that, one other meditation that's used is to contemplate on the true repulsiveness of food. Think about it. The benefits of the meditation on the repulsiveness of food are that you really begin to know the nature of food and of the process. Your mindfulness grows. You understand the lust in yourself, and you are able to let go of it. Meditation on the repulsiveness of food begins with contemplation on the procurement. And you think, if you still eat meat, if you do, of the animals and their carcasses, and the flesh and blood and fat and the disgusting juices that run out when they're cut open. Or if you don't, the food from the earth, and even of the dirt of the earth, of the shit from the cows and the horses, the dirt of all kinds, and you try and wash it off. This whole society is trying to keep your food clean. They put in preservatives. If you read what's sold in the supermarket, there's a paragraph of DHT and DPT and everything else that's put in it to try and keep it from decaying. And you keep it in a refrigerator and you wash it. But just let it stand out in the sun for a short time, and it turns rancid and moldy and hard, are rotten and foul and oozing and fermenting. Okay? And the meditation, as it's given in the scriptures for the monks, is he's eating his food, right? He's dipped his hand into the bowl and is squeezing it up, and the sweat trickling down from his five fingers wets any crisp food that there may be and makes it sodden. And when its good appearance has been spoiled by his squeezing it up, and it's been made into a ball and put into his mouth, then the lower teeth function as a mortar and the upper teeth as a pestle and the tongue as a hand. And it gets pounded there with the pestle of the teeth, like a dog's dinner in a dog's trough, while he turns it over and over with his tongue. And then the thick spittle at the tip of the tongue smears it, and the filth from the teeth in the parts where the toothbrush cannot reach smear it. When thus mashed up and besmeared, this peculiar compound, now destitute of its original color and smell, is reduced to a condition as utterly nauseating as a dog's vomit in a dog's trough. Yet notwithstanding that it is like this, it can still be swallowed. And where does it go? If it is swallowed by one who's 25 years old or 30 years old, it finds itself in a place like a cesspit, unwashed for 25 years or 30 years. So food isn't what it appears. The very highest practice, the place where this initial balance developed, leads to is the development of vipassana mindfulness. This is the mindful observation of all of the mind and body processes that are involved in eating as they change from moment to moment to moment, the thoughts, perceptions, feelings, sensations in the form. To quote the Buddha, the merit made in serving 1,000 meals to the whole order of monks with the Buddha at its head cannot compare to he who develops clear insight into the arising and vanishing of phenomena for just one moment. Okay? So now Joseph will tell you how you can enjoy your eating and then get enlightened at the same time.
The way to stay grounded in all these different techniques and reflections on the experiential level rather than the thought or conceptual level is precisely to develop a very strong mindfulness of all the processes involved in eating. A lot is revealed about our own minds and bodies when we learn to eat with awareness, to eat mindfully. First, we begin to see exactly where it is, exactly that point at which desire arises. We become very mindful of that whole process of desire and our subsequent action upon it. Also, as we're observing the processes involved, there can begin to be a very deep and penetrating insight into the fact that it is all impersonal phenomena happening. There is no self or I or me or mine in the food. There is no self or I in the eating of it, in the awareness of the eating of it. All is empty, impersonal process going on. Eating meditatively is a very profound practice in the sense that one can attain very high states of samadhi and indeed can experience enlightenment in the very process of eating. And there have been many cases in meditation centers or where people are practicing to a very high degree that in the very process of lifting the hand, they may either go into samadhi and the hand just stays there for as long as they're in samadhi, or in the process experience the moment of nirvana, experience enlightenment. It's a very good practice to cultivate. So what we're going to do now is to learn how to analyze with a silent mind to experience all the different mental physical processes involved in eating. The first thing that's done is the intention to look at the food. So that intention should be noted. Intending. Then the head turns so that it can see the food. The turning of the head should be done mindfully, the whole process involved. Turning. As a result of the turning, the food, the color of the food, comes into contact with the eye, and seeing consciousness arises. There should be a mental note, a state of mindfulness with regard to the fact that we are seeing. So seeing. All the eye sees is color. The eye does not see food. Food is a concept. In this practice of mindfulness, we want to stay on the experiential level of the process. So seeing, seeing, seeing. Because of the seeing, the intention arises to move the hand to take the food. The noting of the mental intention before the act should be done very carefully. Intending, intending. Then the movement of the hand should be done very mindfully. Moving, moving, moving. Just experiencing the sensations of movement. No arm, which is a concept. No I, no self, no me, no mine. Simply the impersonal material process of moving and the process of knowing the movement. All done very meditatively, very mindfully, very silently. Silent awareness. Moving, moving, moving. The touching of the food. The experience of the touch sensation. The intention to lift the arm. The mental intention should be noted. Intending, intending, raising. The cause and effect relationship is seen very clearly. Raising, raising. Experience the whole movement of the arm. No I, no me, no mine, no self. Simply movement and the awareness of movement. The arm is brought up. Intention to open the mouth. Intending, intending. The opening of the mouth. Opening, opening. Very aware, very mindful of all the physical processes involved and the process of knowing. Opening the mouth. Intention to put the food into the mouth. Intending, intending. Putting the food into the mouth. Placing the food. The feeling of touch of the food on the tongue. Just touch sensations and the awareness of them. No self, no I, no me, no mine, simply the awareness of sensation. The intention to close the mouth, intending, subsequent closing, not chewing yet. Unless you want to have your meal with your arm in this position. Intending to put the arm down, making the mental intention, then the moving, making the movement the object of mindfulness, the intention to begin chewing, the subsequent chewing process, watching the movement of the mouth, of the jaws, of the teeth, the awareness of taste, the tasting that comes in the process of chewing. And just at this point, there is a very interesting thing which happens. Generally, after the first couple of chews, the taste begins to come out and then disappears. The food is still in the mouth, but rather tasteless. At this very point, because of our desire, our greed for more pleasant taste sensations, we often find the hand again reaching for more food. Food is still in the mouth and we're still chewing it, but the hand is going and taking food and putting in out of our greed for more taste sensation. If we become very mindful of the arising and passing away of the taste and the whole subsequent process of the food being mashed up, then the intention to swallow and the swallowing. Again, the intention arising to take more food, noticing the intention, and then the reaching for the food again, following the whole process through the taking of the food, the intending to move the arm and the moving of the arm and the intention to open the mouth and the opening and the placing, the closing of the mouth, the replacing of the arm, the chewing, the tasting, the swallowing, all very distinct, impersonal processes happening. By cultivating this kind of mindfulness of process, not only do we become aware of how desire for food arises and watch that desire mindfully without identifying with it, but we can really penetrate into the very basic nature of the entire mind-body process. And done very mindfully, it's a very deep and penetrating meditation. As a general suggestion to those of you who are cultivating awareness or mindfulness, it might be a nice exercise to eat one meal a day in silence and very mindfully, very attentive to the entire process involved. It can take a long time, but it doesn't matter, because the entire exercise becomes a meditation. And in this way, we expand the state of mindfulness to cover the entire experience of our activities. Begin to live in a very meditative state.
I've done roughly the same thing each time, of having a huge feast cooked, and we all plan this is going to be the final feast. Everybody gets excited in preparing the feast. Tables laid out, food's placed. Sit down, everybody's anticipating, been building up their hunger, desire. And then I've usually started with a long blessing of the food. And you can see that the cooks are thinking, food's getting cold. And I ask that we keep doing the blessing till everybody is doing the blessing. So the cooks have to give up thinking the food is getting cold in order to do the blessing. Then the blessing's finished and I say, before we eat, I would like to read to you the Buddhist meditation on the repulsiveness of food. Which I then do, and at that point the cooks don't really care whether the food got cold or not. Right? And then I proceed to start in saying the way we will eat, and then lifting, lifting, putting, putting, tasting, tasting, etc. By then the banquet is ruined. And it's an interesting question. If all the years you've been eating for your own pleasure, how much it costs to surrender a little of that pleasure into the becoming mindful of the process of eating. Those of you that have any weight problem will notice if you focus on getting thin, you'll be suffering all the time. But if you become mindful of eating, you will get thin. And those of you that are into cooking and into the exquisite subtleties of food, there's nothing wrong with any of that. That can be done as a yoga too. But we have gone so far overboard now in sense gratification that our ability to even comprehend the use of food as merely survival and maintaining the body has almost been lost completely. Especially because we don't eat demand feeding, we eat schedule feeding at 8, 12, and 6 or whatever.